for cool, that's fine. What I like to do in those situations, I put it on vibrate. I don't know if you have that option. You know, that, what we want to study today is the introduction of one of the great commentaries of the last couple of centuries. He's called the Ksav Kabbalah. He lived about 150 years ago. I never pronounce his name correctly. It's something like Malkenberg. He has a great commentary also on the Sidur, on the davening, which is printed in the Otzer HaTfilos. And he came very much under the influence of the Vilna Gaon. And he has this introduction. Let's open up the Chumash just so we will appreciate his introduction to Chumash Dvarim. So we're looking at Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, the very first Pasuk in the book of Dvarim. And it says, Ela Dvarim Asher Diber Moshe. Okay, so we have Asher Diber Moshe. If anybody else comes in. Asher Diber Moshe. So the Lashon here is Dibur. Now, a little bit later on, we'll have another Lashon, and then a third Lashon. So we'll keep the Chumash open as we go through these three Lashonos, and the Ksav HaKabbalah is going to try to find a justification for these three Lashonos. Now, in Pasuk Aleph, we said Asher Diber Moshe, correct? Now, in Pasuk Gimel, which if you have the blue Chumashim is on page 433, you'll see the top Pasuk there, Gimel says, Diber Moshe El Bnei Yisrael, which is very similar to the opening Lashon, except for the addition of the word Bnei. So we have, at the opening Pasuk says, Asher Diber Moshe El Kol Yisrael. Okay, there are actually two differences. Here it says El Kol Yisrael, and in Pasuk Gimel, it says Diber Moshe El Bnei Yisrael. So number one, the word Bnei is missing in the opening Pasuk, and number two, the third Pasuk is missing the word Kol. Kol Yisrael. Okay. Then we have a whole different Lashon in Pasuk He. There it says, Hoil Moshe, Moshe began, Be'er es HaTorah Zos. It doesn't say Diber, it says Be'er. Be'er sort of means to elucidate the Torah. So what are these three different Lashonos? That's what the Ksav HaKabbalah wants to point out in his introduction. And he does something mind-boggling. He says that these three Lashonos correspond to three different parts or segments of Sefer Dvarim. We could divide Sefer Dvarim into Roman numerals number one, number rule number two, and number rule number three, which itself is a fascinating research project. You know, to take a Chumash and divide it into three sections. And he says that the reason why in the very first five psukim of Sefer Dvarim the Torah uses three different lashonos, that's an introduction, sort of like an overview almost, on the contents of this book of Dvarim. Because these three represent three different purposes, if you will. He calls them Ta'amim, for the Dibur of Moshe. Okay, then, so we have the Dibur at the beginning. Okay? And that first Dibur is what he calls Lashon Kasha. We'll get to understand that in a minute. And then he has Dibur Moshe El Bnei Yisrael. That's not such a Lashon Kasha anymore. And then he finally has Hoel Moshe Be'er Es HaTorah Zos. And on the third line, if you want to underline this, this is the punchline. He says, Yesh B'Sefer Ze Gimel Chalokin. We should divide up the book of Dvarim into three parts. Chelek Aleph, which begins from Perek Aleph and continues until Perek He, which is in Parshas Vayeschanan. And that section, which we'll call Roman numeral number one, takes us all the way up to Aseres HaDibros, and that's called Musar. What does Musar mean? rebuke or chastisement, correct? So the first section of the first part, if you will, of Sefer Dvarim, which takes us for only five chapters, it's actually the smallest section of the three, is Musar, and that's called Diber. Diber is Lashon Kasha. Whenever you want to use a harsh language against someone, that's called Diber. And that's indicated by the opening pasuk here, because that's the first of the three segments of this book, Diber Moshe. Now, it says El Kol Yisrael, so I would just add my own here, if I hope I'm not undermining what the Ksav HaKabbalah, I hope the Ksav HaKabbalah would be satisfied with what I want to add here, and that is Kol Yisrael is critical. When you give Musar, you have to give Musar to the entire nation of Israel, because otherwise, if you leave some out, Rashi points this out, then those who were not there, they would say, hey, you let Moshe Rabbeinu get away with this? If I would have been there, I would have screamed and yelled against Moshe Rabbeinu. Anyway, Chelek HaSheni, what's the second segment? This is the majority of the book of Dvarim. And that takes us until the Brachos and Klolos, which is all the way at the end of Parshas all the way up till Parshas Kitavo. And these are the blessings and the opposite, which Moshe Rabbeinu bestowed upon the people of Israel. I'm sorry, I messed that up. Can I rewind a little bit? Yeah. What I meant to say was that the bulk of the book of Devarim, which is the second segment, that takes us from the Aseres HaDibros in Vaschanon up until Kisavo, up until the Brachos and the Klolos, which is the third segment of the third and last segment of Sefer Dvarim. And he says the following. He says that if you take a look over there, it says Ela Ha'edus, which means the mitzvos. Again, the printing didn't come out too well. I can't read the next word. Veha something or other. I don't know what that is. Shehu Inyan Echad in Vayikra Moshe. Okay, so that's the second segment, and that's called Vayikra Moshe.
What does that mean?
In other words, Moshe is teaching the mitzvos. Now, where it says Vayikra Moshe, we'd have to take a look in Parshas Vaschanon, if we get a chance. I think he says it's in Posuk Mem Hei, I'm not sure. If somebody could take a look in Hei, Memhe, and see if I'm guessing it right. Again, the print here is unfortunately very difficult. Somebody should reprint the Ksav HaKabbalah. It would be a great mitzvah.
He doesn't have a Memhe.
No, it doesn't have. So I don't know what he... Do you see the word Memhe? The letters Memhe. So I don't know. I'm not sure. Anyway, if we had a word search, we would look for Eila HaEdus. So see if you can find Eila HaEdus. I don't have it right now. Okay. So that's the second segment, and that takes us through the majority of Sefer Dvarim. Then we get to Parshas Kisavo, and that's the Brachos of the Klolos, and that's going to take us until the end of the Torah, till the end of Sefer Dvarim. All this is the Vilna Gaon. And he says, V'omar Sham, Kodem HaBrachos, if you take a look in Dvarim Chav Zayin, before we get to the brachos, it says Be'er Hetev. And that Be'er Hetev reflects or corresponds to the Be'er Hetev and that we had here at the beginning of Sefer Dvar. He says Vizbonin, and you should analyze and investigate ki Hascholas Shlosha Chelke HaSefer Zeh Kascholas Gimel HaSfarim. He says you can also find a parallel between these three sections and the three openings of the other books, leaving out Breishis, and that's the books of Shmos, Vayikra, and Bamidbar. Because Shmos begins with the word Ele, Vayikra, of course, with the word Vayikra, and Bamidbar with the word Vayidaber. Vayikra is mole halachos. So the word ele reflects on the halachic dimension. Ukinegdo, Dvarim Nami Mole Halachos. So the middle section of Dvarim, which is the major part of Sefer Dvarim, parallels the Vayikra of Sefer Vayikra, because Sefer Vayikra from beginning to end, pretty much, maybe a little exception at the end, but it's all halacha. So Vayikra indicates halacha. Klomar also chelik shem Sefer Dvarim shu keneged Sefer Vayikra shesham medubar min mitzvos. The subject is the mitzvahs who mole halachas hagra. Okay, all this is based on the Vilna Gaon. Vehi hayara nifla v'nacham mi'od, and he, the Ksav HaKabbalah, gives the Gaon an accolade here. He gives him a special honor for presenting this thesis of dividing up the book of Dvarim into three parts. And he says that lechinam, he says all the other mefarshim, when they try to reconcile these different languages at the beginning of the book of Dvarim, starting with the word Eile, they all have problems with this. They don't really solve the problem.
How does the beginning of Shmos and Bamidbar correspond with the first sections of Torah?
I think he's saying the following, if I understand correctly, that the book of Bamidbar is full of Musar, because it tells the story of all the different people.
Amidbar equates to the first section of
Vayikra, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe, let me just think this out for a second. He's talking about Brachos and Klolos, and then he's talking about Musa.
Correct.
So let's just think. Which he doesn't spell out which of the other two parallel which correspond. Let's just make a quick calculation if we can. That in, I'm not sure, I don't know. Let's take a look at another introduction of the same author, but here we fast forward to Pasuk Tesvav. So that you'll find on page 434. And it says there the following: Va'ekach es roshei shivteichem, anoshim chachomim v'yudum, etein osam roshim aleichem. So these are the heads of the Shvatim. And he subdivides them into four categories. He says there's a Sari Alofim. Each one is in charge of 1,000 Jews. So, for example, if we assume that the population of the Jewish people is 600,000, so how many Sari Alofim would there be? 600. Does everybody have that? The Sari Meos. Those are those who are in charge of 100. Sari Hamishim. The Sari Asaros. So we have four different categories, and it ends up with the Shotrim Lishivtechem. So he says the following, the Ksav HaKabbalah. He says these four categories, each one has his own function. So it's not just a matter of how many people come under their tutelage, so to speak. You know, it's not just a numbers game, but there's a qualitative difference between each one of these categories. And he divides it up in the following way. He says, number one, we have Sari Alofim are in charge of Milchama. When do we, and how do we go out to war, to battle? And when do we return, hopefully victorious, in Mirz Hashem? That's the Minui of the Sari Alofim. Then we go down to the Sari Ameos for 100. And their job are the Shoftim. They're in charge of judgment. So to which sire would you go for judgment or litigation? That would be the Sari Ameos. And he bases himself on a pasuk in Parshas Pinchas. There it says, Vayiktsof Moshe. No, this is in Parshas Matos. Vayiktsof Moshe al Pkudei Hachayel Sari Alofim V'Sari Ameos Haboyim Mitzvah Milchama. It sounds like the Sari Ameos maybe have had a double function. Notice the primary responsibility of going out to battle was on the Sari Alofen. The Sari Meos had a different function, but they also played a role in the military campaign. V'chein vayikruvu el Moshe hapkudim asher li alfei hatzav v'Sari Alofen v'Sari Meos. Okay. So again, there's a minui of Sari Alofim. They are the primary responsible leaders as far as military campaigns. Then we have the Sari Ameos, which may, to some extent, share some of the responsibilities of the Sari Ameos, but they're uniquely in charge of what's called Shiput, which means judgment. And then we get down to the Sari Achamishim. They were in charge of teaching Torah to Israel, the transmission of Torah. They are called as Canaan. And then we get down, now he says, Hema ma'ulim shebekulam. Interesting. You know, you would have intuitively said that the highest level of all these four minuyim, these appointees, would have been the Sari Alofim, or the Sari Ameos, but he says no. The most important task was, how should I say, placed on the shoulders, the responsibility of the Zekanim, namely the Sari HaChamishim. They were teaching Torah. And therefore, in the parish of Klolos, we begin with them. You know, they were responsible for any lacks, you know, if there was any deficiency in the passage of Torah, the observance of Torah, that was their responsibility. Now, I'm skipping a line here, and he goes down to the Sari Asoros. What role was placed on the shoulders of the Sari Asoros? They were the Shotrim. You remember at the end of this pasuk here, we said, Sari Asoros v'shotrim lishiv teichem. This is what we call the executive branch of government, or the police force. They were in charge of making sure that any decision that was handed down by the Sari Ameos would be implemented. That's Lekayim Psak HaDin, he says, to implement. Are you familiar in modern Hebrew with the word Achifat HaMishpat? That's in modern Hebrew, you know, when they talk about the implementation, you know, to make sure that the verdicts of the judges are carried out. He says, V'hayu Azkenim. He said, and all this again is in the name of the Gaon, as you'll see in a minute. Right? See, Sahayu Askenim Kefel Keneged Ashotrim. I'm not sure what he means by Kefel over here, because the Askenim were the Sari Chamishim.
They were twice as many.
They were twice as many? How does he know them?
Because if there are so many in charge of hundreds, there'll be twice as many in charge of 50s, because 50 is half the value. So that's Kefel, isn't it?
Oh, I see. One second. So the Shoftim are the Meos. Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right. I got mixed up. I read it as Shotrim, but Shoftim, you're right. Yeah. So the Shoftim was Sari HaMeos, and the Zkenu, who were teaching Torah, was Sari HaMishim. And why were they double? No, it's the ratio between the teachers of Torah and the judges would be 2-1. Lefisha HaMishpat Eino El Bayom. But Limud Torah is Bein Bayom Bein Balayla. Fascinating idea that there's no time limitation in teaching Torah. It applies both by day and by night. Whereas you can only issue a judgment call during by day. So we only needed them as a halftime, so to speak. You know, they were. And he says that this is a brilliant pshat. And he says, based on this pshat of the Gaon, he wants to answer a question on the Sugyan Sanhedrin. And this is the question of Tosus and the Ran in Masechta Sanhedrin. Because the Gemara establishes that there were 600 Sari Alofim, there were 6,000 Sari Meos, there were 12,000 Sari Chamishim, and there were 60,000 Sari Asara, which all sounds very nice mathematically, but it makes absolutely no sense. Why? Because after all, the whole calculation of the Gemara is based on the number 600,000, right? That's called Shishim Ribu, which is the makeup of Klal Yisrael. But he says if you calculate them, then l'chori you're gonna have to omit from the calculation the Sarim themselves, right? Because again, this ratio is between the leaders of Klal Yisrael and the rank and file members of Klal Yisrael. So why don't you subtract, let's say, for example, in the case of Sari Alofim, there were 600 Sari Alofim. So they should not be included in the calculation. And then when you finally get to the Sari HaChamishim, I'm sorry, let's say the Soria Soria, you're talking about six, right? You're talking about 60,000. So you're going to have to subtract those 60,000 from the 600,000.
I'm not sure that's true. I'm not sure that's true logically. I don't have to do that.
Why not? I mean, that's Tosfos in the Ran. You can argue against them if you like, but you're up against a big big guns here.
That's why you have to exclude them. They're part of the total.
Oh, anyway, so he says that L'divrei Agra ain't makom l'tmihasam. Again, you, Michael, it could be possible that you're under the influence of the Gaon here. What do I mean?
Could be.
The Gaon is saying that each one of these four groups, the Soria Lofim, etc., down to the Soria Hasora, they all had each one of those groups had its own unique function. Ikar hasmonis levado. There was no exclusion. Let's say, for example, you were elected to be one of those 600 Soria Alofim. Your goal as one of that group of Soria Alofim was to take the people out to battle, but it doesn't exclude you from all the other judgments that you need.
Exactly.
Yeah, but this is only after the Gaon. You know, you're talking almost seven centuries, you know, that they didn't have an answer to the question of the Tosfos and the Ran until the Gaon came along. Because before the Gaon, what we thought was the difference between the those who wore the sweatshirt, you know, I'm one of the Soria Alofim, and those who wore on the sweatshirt, I'm one of the Soria Asara, was only a difference in terms of the quality of the person, if you follow what I mean. But they all had the same function. It's only the Vilna Gaon who came up with this brilliant breakthrough. You see, I pedagogically didn't feed you the right information. I gave you the punchline before. The simple shot before the Vilna Gaon is that all these four groups, they were all Sarim, you know. Maybe you could talk about how many people, you know, came under their tutelage, but basically whatever tutelage meant, whatever they were in charge of, we never understood that there were four different functions before the Gaon came along. Basically, we're talking about the Sarim. Some Sarim would have, you know, it was like imagine a hierarchy in the courts, right? You have the Supreme Court, and then you have the civil courts, and the district courts, and then the smaller courts, and the municipal courts. That's the way we understood before the Gaon came along, this distinction. So who sat on the Supreme Court? Those were the Soria Lofim. Who sat on the lower court? They're the Soria Meos and so forth. But they were all equal. And therefore, there was no jurisdiction of one judge over the other. Right, we were all talking about judges. Comes along the Vilna Gaon and says, we're not talking about judges at all. The judges were the Soria Meos. You know, they were in charge of Shiput. But each one of these four had a different function, says the Gaon, and therefore they're all included in the same count. Okay, that's what I wanted to get out of this piece, just to introduce you to the Ksav Kabbalah. You should know that the Ksav Kabbalah is coming back into vogue. You know, it was out of vogue. Okay, now we get to the next, you know, if you could pass this around. I made four copies, so there should be enough to go around and more. But you have to take two, if you follow me, because that's the way that could be. Okay, no, take two pages, if you know what I mean. Okay, and then pass this around. Everyone take two pages. Okay. So this is the Shvilei Pinchas. And this is the only one I was able to find for Dvarim, because all the rest are on what's called Shabbat Chazon. You know, they're all about Tisha B'Av. And I was a little bit more interested in Parshas Dvarim at this point. So if you have the Chumash, again, if you're opening up the beginning of Parshas Dvarim, then we're going to look again at Pasuk Gimel on page 433. And the Torah describes the end. We're talking about the end of the 40th year. So Moshe Rabbeinu's career is coming to an end, and we're up to the 12th month. Ashtei Asar Chodesh B'Echad L'Chodesh. If you take a look at Rashi says on Pasuk Gimel Malamit Shalom Hochichon El Samach L'Misa. So it's very close to his death. That's when he gives Tochacha. And Rashi gives a long-winded explanation as to why he he waits and he chooses to delay his castigation, his mussar, until the end of his life. A long discussion, which is not for us right now, because we want to focus our attention on three words in the pasuk. In pasuk hey, it says be'eras haTorah zos. So Rashi says, what does it mean, Be'eras HaTorah? If you have the blue chumashim on the top of the left column, do you have those words here? In Rashi, the top of the left column? Jeremy, are you able to read that for me, just so I know you're on the right page? Because these four words are going to occupy our minds for the next half hour, as much time as you can stay. You're on page 433?
Yeah.
Are you on the left column in Rashi?
Yeah.
Okay, can you read those four words in Rashi? On the left column.
Yeah.
Read it just a little louder, because my ears don't hear you.
What's that?
Pirsha Lahem. Okay, then?
Yeah.
So Rashi says that Moshe Rabbeinu presented the Torah in how many languages? 70 languages. And this is going to be a Pella for us, this Rashi. And that's going to occupy our minds for the rest of the time that we have together today, Ritz Hashem. Rashi is talking about Moshe Rabbeinu at the end of his career, translating, if you will, the Torah into 70 languages. And this is something very strange, because, you know, it would seem that perhaps at the time of Matan Torah, the Torah was given in only one language, namely Lashon Kodesh, the Holy Tongue. But yet, at the end of his career, Moshe Rabbeinu Be'er as HaTorah Zos, meaning he translated or explained it in 70 languages. And the obvious question is, why was he doing so? So there's Gemara in Masechta Shabbos Daf Pei Ches. If you have the handout that I gave you, you'll take a look at the third paragraph on the first page. A statement of Rabbi Yochanan based on a pasuk in Tehillim. The David HaMelech says in Tehillim, Hashem Yitain Omer HaMivsarot Tzvarav. And Rabbi Yochanan interprets this as saying that Kol Dibur V'Dibur Sheyotza Mipi HaGvura Nechlak L'Shivim L'Shonos. And he's taking us back to the moment of Matan Torah. And even at the moment of Matan Torah, there was an amazing supernatural event in which the words of the Torah came out from the mouth of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and split into 70 Lashonos. Now, you would think that if, let's say, Klal Yisrael at that point in time, when they got the Torah, they weren't able to understand 70 languages. And the Brisa quoted in the Gemara in Shabbos Peches says, in the name of Tanit Bei Rav Yishmael, that this is like a patish yifotzei sela. You know, if you take a large stone, and then you take a major sledgehammer, and you smash it, it comes out into 70 different small shards, right? And they sort of like... So every single Dibur of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was split into 70 languages. However, although that took place, it doesn't seem like the people of Israel understood those 70 languages.
It wasn't for them, was it? It was for the other nations.
Oh, so that's the question. Is it for the other nations? We'll soon see that the Gemara is going to tell us that the other nations rejected the Torah. They weren't interested in the Torah.
I thought also it was forbidden to actually do that. There was this whole thing when they were told to translate.
Right, the Septuagint. Yeah, that's another kasha. So we're going to have a whole bunch of kashas here. That was the phone that you said you had to get. And we're going to teach you how to get it on vibrate. But my understanding of phones is very limited. But one thing I can do is put it on vibrate. It doesn't mean I remember to do that when I should. So anyway, you see a paragraph called Omnom, which should be the fourth paragraph on your page. He says, Tzarech Bir, I don't understand. If the Torah was given in the first year after they came out of Mitzrayim, which is the month of Sivan, why does Moshe Rabbeinu wait 40 years until the end of his career? And that's on the first of Shvat. Again, Moshe Rabbeinu dies just about a month later. I mean, on the 7th, 5 weeks later. So this is 5 weeks before he dies. And Moshe Rabbeinu explains the Torah to the people of Israel in 70 languages. So again, there's some metaphysical event, a supernatural event that happened 40 years earlier, in which the Torah itself was somehow metaphysically given in 70 languages, but the actual, shall we say, transmission of the 70 languages in the translation of the Torah waited for 40 years until Moshe Rabbeinu was about to end his lifetime. So we have two questions here. Question number one is, what's the significance of, back at the time of Matan Torah, of the Torah being given in 70 languages? And question number two, assuming that Klal Yisrael didn't understand the 70 languages, why did Moshe Rabbeinu feel compelled at the end of his career to translate and explain the Torah in 70 languages? And the entire presentation that we're about to see, and I'm very excited about it, is based on a medrash. This medrash, which appears in Bereishis Rabbah towards the end of Sefer Bereishis, is interpreting a pasuk again in Tehillim, not the pasuk that we saw before in Tehillim Samaches, but earlier in Tehillim, in Perek Chaf Hei. And there the pasuk says, Sod Hashem Liyareov. And the medrash takes the word Sod, Samach Vav Dalet, and translates it or calculates it in arithmetic. Anybody know what Sod 70, right? Because the Samach is 60, the Vav is 4, is 6, the Dalet is 4, and that totals 70. And Sod Hashem Liyareov means that in the parsha of Bris Milah, again we have to know why it's Bris Milah and how Bris Milah ties into that. But it says the following: Lo gila osa me adam viad esrim dar. In other words, until Avram Avinu, 20 generations had passed by before God revealed this secret of the bris, which is the bris milah, to Avram Avinu. And it says veetna brisi beiniu veinecha. So again, this medrash is at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha, or actually, the medrash itself appears. I'm sorry. I made a mistake. I said to you the medrash at the end of Sefer Bereishis. It's really not at the end of Sefer Bereishis. That was my mistake. It's only Os Mem Tes, not Perek Mem Tes. It's in Perek Yud Zayin when the pasuk describes the bris that's given to Avraham Avinu as Vietna Brisi Beinu Veinecha. So Avraham Avinu, as the father of Klal Yisrael, gets a secret, and that secret is going to be the bris milah. But then the Medrash goes on and says more than that. Shivim, and why? So it again is the number 70. Ani ma'amid mimcha b'schus hamila. That from you, Avraham Avinu, the descendants will be, as a result of the or in merit of this great mitzvah of mila, will be 70. What's 70? These are 70 souls that go down to Mitzrayim. And not only that, these refer to the 70 Zkenim, because Moshe Rabbeinu gathers together 70 elders that form the High Court of Israel. And moreover, the number 70 indicates that Moshe Rabbeinu is going to study and teach the Torah in 70 languages. And the Medrash quotes the Pasuk Ho'il Moshe, that's our Pasuk at the beginning of Sefer Dvarim, Be'er Es HaTorah Zos. And what does Rashi tell us? That Be'eras HaTorah Zos means that Moshe Rabbeinu taught the Torah at the last year of his, the last month almost of his life, into 70 languages. And all this somehow comes as a prophecy to Moshe, to Avraham Avinu, that all this is a result of the Bris Milah. So again, it's unbelievable. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling Avraham Avinu that he will be Zocher to the number 70 in many different ways and in many different contexts. And the last context of which is Moshe Rabbeinu's translation of the Torah into 70 languages. So why is Hashem revealing Moshe Rabbeinu the Torah Sod Hashem Li'ireov, the secret of 70 languages, why is that necessary? And not only that, the Medrash seems to indicate that Klal Yisrael go out of Mitzrayim in the schus of Shaloshinu Eshma Veslashona, that the people of Israel were very dedicated to the Hebrew language, and they weren't interested in learning the languages of the other nations. And now we're saying that in order to understand the Torah has to be given in 70 languages. Why is that? And, you know, the question is, if it's important for Bnei Yisrael to understand the Torah, then if they understood Loshinu as Lashonim, they didn't change their language, they were dedicated to Lashon Kodesh, so why is it necessary to translate the Torah into 70 tongues?
The word Mal, meaning the bris, is actually mantra 70. You know that?
That's interesting. Okay, so maybe that also ties
doesn't
in.
Say that then.
I didn't see that, but...
Mem Lamed is 70, so maybe that's where the 70 comes from.
So Michael pointed out before that maybe this translation of the Torah into 70 languages for the benefit of the nations of Israel, for the nations of that occupy the world, the 70 languages. So he rejects that in this paragraph of Zosfi Od, which is in the middle of your middle bottom of your middle column, and he quotes the famous Chazal that HaKadosh Baruch Hu checked out all the nations of the world and asked them if they want to receive the Torah. That's based on a pasuk in Lamed Giv Dvarim, Lamed Giv Vayom Hashem, Hashem Misinai Bo Vizarech Meisir Lomo, and they rejected it. He went to Klal Yisrael and they accepted the Torah. So now, why is it necessary in the 40th year of Moshe Rabbeinu's career, before his, you know, his leaving, departing the people of Israel and the world, that he translate the Torah into the 70 languages? That's called Sod is 70. If you're going to tell me it's in order to explain the Torah, make it accessible to the 70 nations of the world, well, they rejected the Torah. So why translate the Torah into 70 languages? And again, we could add what Michael mentioned before, and that is that the translation of the Torah, if it's made to be accessible to the nations of the world, that's something that we... You know, that was, you know, we fast for that. In Asar B'Tevis, one of the reasons we fast on the 10th of Tevis is because this terrible, you know, the Hefkeris, meaning that now the Torah was translated, the Septuagint, you know, and it became accessible to the nations of the world. That we don't want to do. It was translated to Greek, which is a discussion in itself. We'll leave that for Asar B'Tevis. So he basically wants to combine the insights of four of the great giants. Number one, the Kedushas HaLevi, his name was Rav Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev. Number two, the Chidush HaRim, who was the founder of Gera Chassidus. Number three, the Apta Rav, which is the Oy of Yisrael. And number four, the Sokhet Shammah Rebbe, the Avnei Nezer. So I don't know if we're going to get to finish up in the time that we have all four, but at least we'll get to do, Mirtz Hashem, two out of the four. Maybe we'll leave the other two for Yom Shlishi, I don't know, we'll see, whatever you're up to. But let's start with the Kedushas HaLevi. The Kedushas Levi says, we're now on the left column of page 1, and we're about to learn the darkened, bold print in the second and third paragraphs on this page. That's the Kedushas Levi, who says that, and I'm just going to summarize the punchline here, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows the future, and he knows that the people of Israel, after they conquer the land, at some point down the line, they're going to be sent into exile. They're going to live amongst the nations of the world. What's going to keep them, what's going to maintain their existence as a unique nation when they're intermingled in the various galiot, in the various nations of the world? It's going to be the Torah, and specifically the translation of the Torah into 70 languages. And he writes the following, that this pasuk that we're studying now, Ho'il Moshe Be'eretz HaTorah, opens up with Eretz Moav. Eretz Moav is a country which speaks a different language. And Lama, why, asks the Kedushas HaLevi, Be'er Kan HaTorah, why is Moshe Rabbeinu at this particular juncture translating the Torah into 70 languages? And he points out that there are a number of words in the Torah that are written not in Lashon Kodesh, but rather in a different language. For example, in the parsha of Lavan and Yaakov, it says Yigar Sa'adusa, and that comes from the Aramaic language. Or for example, tefillin are called by the Torah Totafos. Totafos, it comes from Greek, right, to Tat Bekasve. And he gives another example. He says, those are the two examples he gives. So these words in the Torah come from other languages. Why was it necessary to incorporate these words from other languages into the Torah, which is otherwise written in Lashon Kodesh? And he says the following, that the language of all the nations, the 70 languages, give a certain existence or a certain reality or a chiyus, he calls it, a living force, a life force, ilan vital, to these nations. The ilan vital, the force, the life-giving force to the people of Israel is Lashon HaKodesh, and only Lashon HaKodesh. And Bnei Yisrael received the Torah at Har Sinai b'Lashon HaKodesh, that's all that they heard. However, HaKadosh Baruch Hu understands that down the line, the people of Israel are going to enter into the Golios. They're going to live amongst the Moavim and all the other nations. And here, they're in a sense cut off, if you will, from Lashon HaKodesh, because they're in an atmosphere in which they're surrounded by other languages. He says that because the Jewish people are being subjected to exile, living amongst the other nations, there's a tremendous jeopardy, a sakana, he says, that they will, in a sense, the people of Israel will attach themselves to the chiyus, to the life force of the other nations, because now they're living amongst the other nations. And in a funny kind of, how shall I say, a paradoxical sense, they are dedicated to the Lashon of the Torah, of their Lashon, which is Lashon HaKodesh. However, now they need to be connected to a different source of chiyus in the various countries that they live in. And that compels them to link up to the 70 languages. Now again, all this is somewhat obfuscated, not clear. So that's what the Shvilei Pinchas wants to try to understand and clarify the insights of Rabbi Levi Yitzchak Mibaditshva and the Kedushas HaLevi. And he says the following. This is in the paragraph that starts Narchiv Ktsas and goes on to the second page. And he points out that there's a fundamental principle that the nations of the world come under the influence of what's called 70 Sarei Mala. Each one of the nations of the world has its celestial angel that's in charge of that particular nation. And these angels represent the antithesis, you know, the hisnagdus, if you will, to the three elements of Kedusha. Why? Because these nations are dedicated to the worship of Avodah Zarah. And therefore, number one, they're antithetical to the Kedusha of one God in the universe, because they have many gods, pluralistic gods. Number two, to the sanctity of Israel, who are Banim LaMakom. So, you know, insofar as they undermine these nations, the sanctity of God, then ipso facto, they undermine the sanctity of God's children, the people of Israel. And finally, they undermine, and they're antithetical to the Kedusha HaTorah that was given to Bnei Yisrael at Har Sinai. So these are the, you know, they reject A, B, and C. And that's why in all these nations, wherever they occupy, you know, geographically, any location on the face of the earth, those nations on a spiritual level, locations on a spiritual level, are overwhelmed by choshech v'afela, spiritual darkness. They don't have any connection to the light of the Torah, and therefore they're dedicated totally and exclusively to enjoy the benefits of this world in a hedonistic, mad, craving desire, and bring darkness into the world. Now, if you take a look on the next page, He says that the Jewish people, for whatever reason, after going to Golus, they're completely surrounded in each country, in each city, by the control of those angels of the 70 nations of the world. It's one little shepherd, or one little lamb, that is surrounded by 70 wolves, and the people of Israel are in Golus in a very precarious situation in which their very existence is considered in a danger zone. Danger zone meaning there's such a jeopardy here that they may cease to exist. Why? Because the darkness that controls that area, that dominates in those areas where the 70 nations of the world occupy each one respectively its location, that's called a mechitza shel barzel. That's a very strong separation, a barrier that separates anybody in that area from connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and His Torah. So the people of Israel are now in a very great sakana, a great jeopardy to their life. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets up, even before the Makkah, even before the people of Israel enter into those areas of Golus, He gives a trufa, a cure, what do you say?
Medicine.
A medicine before the Makkah. Okay, before the Makkah. That's called Makdim Trufa LaMakkah. And Hashem reveals to Moshe Rabbeinu the 70 languages. And why is that so? Because by revealing the 70, by translating the Torah into 70 languages, he says, again, I'm going to read to you his very mystical language. He says, Chodrim nitzotzos or haTorah into the Shivim umos ha'olam. That somehow sparks of the light, the supernal light, the internal infinite light of the Torah, somehow penetrate into the 70 nations wherever they are. This is very much influenced by the Arizal, because the Arizal speaks about the klipos, which are, you know, the external entities of the 70 nations. But each one of those klipos has a nitzotz, has some sort of a spark or a potential for sanctity.
And Rabbi Cook in the Orot HaTshuva is talking about
this. Excellent. Rav Cook in the Orot HaTshuva. I didn't know that. I mean, I tried to read Orot HaTshuva. I didn't get by the first page. The Hebrew is way above my level. This Hebrew, by the way, is also above my level, but I can grapple with it. I can deal with it. So he says the following, that in the nations of the world, there is some sort of a trapped spark. And that spark is a spark of sanctity that comes from the Or HaTorah, from the light of the Torah, that penetrates into the 70 nations, each one respectively, so that when Klal Yisrael find themselves in the Golus, under the control, the sovereign rule of that particular nation, multiply that by 70, but in that particular nation, they can somehow connect and free those trapped spiritual sparks that have entered and penetrated into the darkness and are completely enveloped by the darkness of that nation. But they, the people of Israel, can connect not to the darkness of that nation, because that would leave Chas V'Shalom to the extinction of Klal Yisrael as a separate Ummah, but rather to link into the Nitzotzos, those sparks of light that are somehow trapped in the Umos HaOlam. And by doing so, they can break down that, remember we spoke about that iron, you know, the iron curtain that is a barrier, and they can dedicate themselves to Torah. And they could use those languages of the local vernacular of that language. You know, like, for example, English. So what we know that the English language, and before English, Yiddish, let's say Yiddish for Ashkenazim, Yiddish is a language that's really a corruption of German and other languages. And it's unbelievable how developed the Yiddish language is in terms of study of Torah. Again, there are also idiomatic expressions that are very sophisticated. There's literature in Yiddish, which I'm not so familiar with. My father, the show, loved Yiddish literature. He could be tested, he told me once, backwards and forwards on Shalom Aleichem, 7 books.
Don't you find it strange that German, which was the language the Nazis used to kill us, and yet the people in it, they'll only speak, most of them, will only speak Yiddish, It's a very strange.
Right, I would even go beyond that, Michael. I'm not so interested in Mea Shearim as much as I'm interested in the passage and the transmission of Torah. The transmission of Torah in Yiddish is on the highest level, Rabbi Osai. Yeah. There are things in Yiddish which my father tried to translate to me in English, and he was not always. And he, my father was, he was a scholar in English, but to translate the Torah Yiddish, just to strengthen your question, into English, he said was nearly virtually impossible. There were certain words that in Yiddish language that you could never really adequately translate into English. And I believe personally that now the English language has taken on new. You'll see the art scroll. You know, there's certain words that art scroll uses in a very unique way. I'm not a bucky in art scroll, but my Rebbe, for example, at some point right before I came into the Shia, he decided to change the language of instruction from Yiddish to English, and he did a marvelous job in English. And he created new terminology, a new in Hebrew it's called minuach, new phrases and words to explain the Torah on the highest and most profound level. So again, you're asking Akash on Yiddish because it's a bastardization of German, but you could ask that question on almost any language. Again, the Nazi Holocaust was in sheer numbers. There's nothing in Jewish history that can compare to it. But trust me, the Greeks and the Romans and the Brits, anti-Semitism is not, it's not just a German monopoly. Every nation on the face of the earth has subjugated the Jewish people. Some worse and greater numbers, and some in lesser numbers. And yet, what saved us, according to the thesis of the Bar Dichava, is the fact that we were able to understand the Torah and convey the Torah in those languages. Otherwise, he said we would have been totally lost. And how did that language impact on the darkness of those places, those locations where we found ourselves? My father, for example, came from a certain part of Poland. He said, from one day to the next, we had to uproot from one shtetl to another shtetl, because if the local population decided, of the goyim that today is going to be pogrom day, and let's get rid of the Jews, I mean, less din v'less dayan, there was no one who could prevent them. So the Jews were always, and this is true for Sephardic Jews also to some extent, although it was the golden age of Spain, but with that came to a conclusion. The Jews found themselves in Portugal, and from Portugal they went to Syria, and from Syria they went to this country, and that country, and that country. In that sense, Sfaradim and Ashkenazim have a common tradition, And according to the thesis of the Kedush Salevi, the Torah had to be translated into all these languages in order to guarantee the continuity, the continued existence of the Jewish people, that somehow the Torah would penetrate into those languages and into those cultures and into those dark locations on the face of the earth and allow the Jewish people to find and discover and link up with those nitzotzos of Kedusha, those sparks of eternity and sanctity. And standing on the shoulders of the Kedusha Salevi comes the Sfas Emes. You remember we said that we're going to try to cover two out of the four. This is number two. And he quotes the Chidush Arim, who was his grandfather. And he writes that Yesh Shivam Umos Olam Ayin Madrego 70 levels of Hisnagdus L'Kedusha. Okay, you're talking about the black, bolded paragraph in the middle of page 2, column 1, if you call it. And on the third line, he says that the 70 nations of the world represent 70 different dimensions of Hisnagdus L'Kedusha. In other words, every one of the 70 nations in its own way, in her own way, each one of these countries, took their culture as antithetical to sanctity, to Torah, in its own unique way. So Moshe Rabbeinu had to take the sanctity of the Torah, the light of Torah, and he had to find 70 different ways of countering against the 70 different, antithetical methods or dimensions of the nations of the world. So he would expand the Ora Torah in 70 different ways, such that in one Golus after the other, the Jewish people would be able to counter that, again, whatever was relative to that particular nation or that culture, their antithetical, you know, their anti-Torah, the Torah Madrega. And we needed desperately these 70 languages in order to find in the 70 languages a way of linking up to the Torah, of utilizing the 70 languages to transmit the Torah, and by doing so we would counter the 70 madregos, again relative to each language and each culture, wherever we found ourselves, so it's 1 times 70, methods of, through their languages, using their languages to counter against the influence of the negative influence, the antithetical influence of that particular culture. And he writes that each one of the umos, kol achas mem miyuchad bira'a acheres, each one represents a special kind of evil. Do you understand what's going on here, Abosai? You know, this is like an anthropology or a cultural study of the relationship between idol worship, idolatry, and on the one hand, and lahavdil elef havdalos, the kedusha of Torah on the other hand. And every single culture develops its own way, its own particular, shall I say, philosophical or way of thinking, which is antithetical to the Kedushas HaTorah. And that particular, you know, dimension and that particular culture is going to envelop that whole area in spiritual darkness. Again, you won't see darkness. The sun is shining bright. Heim omdim umuchanim b'inyonam levatal es Yisrael. And these powerful influences of evil, multiplied by 70 and 70 nations, 70 locations, has the power to undermine the people of Israel. And that's why Chazal say, Shivim Panim LeTorah, LaOraisa. Have you ever heard of that? Now, I always understood, I'll have to admit my ignorance, that Shivim Panim LeTorah means that you can interpret any piece of Torah in 70 different ways. I don't know if anyone here can identify with that. But he says, no, Shivim Panim LeTorah means something totally different. Shivim Panim LeTorah is an allusion, is a reference to the 70 nations of the world, and the Torah has to be given 70 ways, 70 dimensions, in order to undermine and encounter and overcome the 70 different methods of anti-Torah in the 70 philosophies of the 70 Umos HaOlam. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu translated the Torah into 70 languages, and what he was able to achieve was that Klal Yisrael, in the various respective Golios of the 70 nations, would be Dovak LaTorah. They would have a control and a rulership over their Shoresh, which is Torah, and with that they could be Mavatal, they could protect themselves against the influence of that country, of that Golos. And it's all because of the 70 languages that Moshe Rabbeinu translated the Torah into 70 languages. And you know, I'm thinking out loud. I'm just talking here about what I'm familiar with in America. Back in my youth, you know, there were many, many European Jews who came to the shores of America and became teachers of Torah. And again, you know, I can get in deep trouble for what I'm about to say, but I honestly believe that you could divide the success of these rabbis into two categories. Who are the ones who belong to the successful category and who to the other category? It all depends upon whether they mastered the local language. Now, on a very technical level, you know, superficial level, that means that the young people in America were gradually weaned away from Yiddish. And the Rebbeim who only spoke Yiddish were not able to communicate with the younger generation. Can you relate to what I'm saying? I mean, does that touch on any of your experience in life? Again, you may be very familiar with Yiddish, but for those of the youth who didn't know Yiddish, like, for example, in our yeshiva, there was a rashi by the name of Reb David Lifshitz, all of a sudden. And Reb David decided at one point to teach his shiurim instead of Yiddish in Lashon Kodesh, in Hebrew. Again, it wasn't the Lashon Kodesh of the modern Israelis. You know, it was you know, it was
biblical
Hebrew, but it was unbelievable. He went from 5 students to all of a sudden 50 students, and then he doubled that. You know, people really loved Rav David Shiurim. It was in Ivris, you know, in the Lashon Kodesh, but they were able to understand. And at that point, the younger generation didn't know Yiddish. So that's on one level. But on a deeper level, what we're saying is that we need that language in our culture. We need to dip in to the vernacular in order to counter the influences of the culture. Again, you could explain it sociologically and psychologically and in many different ways. You know, if the culture is full of filth, if you pardon the expression, in that language, then, you know, our youth, unfortunately, is going to be exposed to that filth. But I think on a more abstract level, conceptually or metaphysically, what we're talking about is using that language in that particular culture to convey and transmit the Torah. And what it means in the metaphysics of it, according to the mystics here, is that the Moshe translates the Torah into a different language, 7 times 70, and by translating into that different language, we're able to use that language to free the nitzotzos of Kedusha, the sanctified elements, and keep us going as a nation. So again, this has many different perspectives. But the critical part here is that when we go into Golus, and that's part of the divine plan, which was clear to the Ribbono Shel Olam from the get-go, we must master that language of that particular nation and culture where we find ourselves. And that's the only way we could protect ourselves, by taking that language and using it for Torah. And Moshe Rabbeinu facilitated that when he got the command from God, or shall I say the revelation from God of those languages, giving us the Torah in those languages. Which means that those languages now become a conduit for conveying and transmitting the Torah. Those languages themselves now take on an element of Kedusha. Now again, you know, you're asking Michael a very deep question about German as a language. I can only tell you this. And again, I'm not telling you, you'll be satisfied with my answer, but in the philosophy of the Arizal, everything that exists has to have some connection to sanctity. Now, you'll ask me about Amolek, you know, how does Amolek connect in any way to sanctity? I mean, it's pure evil, and that's why we have to completely destroy Amolek. But from a mystical point of view, there's something that connects to sanctity, which means to divinity, otherwise it ceases to exist. So there is something even in the German language, you know, which allows us to find a method and a transmission of the Torah in German, and the Jews were very much exposed to the German language, you know, for many, many centuries. That's the best I can do. I would almost be willing to say that the German language per se is like any other language. The Nazis, Yimach Shemam, the Amalekim of that door, they took the German language under Hitler, Yimach Shemam, and they made it into what they made it into. You know, to the most disgusting language that you can imagine. You go to Austria, for example, and you listen to the Austrian language, it sounds like German, and you get all upset. Although, I don't know, the Israelis now are traveling to Austria, I don't know.
But all this runs counter to the whole question that I raised earlier about when it came to translate the Septuagint, then it was, you know, they were like forbidden to do it.
Right, because again, we're going to use those languages to interpret and transmit the Torah. We're not going to offer those languages. And read the introduction to Art Scroll. He's got major issues there. You know, he writes that he gathered together, he gives you a list of all the Gedolim until they finally gave their okay. But in pure theory, what Art Scroll does is it really makes the Torah, in this case Torah Shebal Peh, all of Shas in that case. I mean, and it goes way beyond Shas, but accessible to the non-Jews. Any non-Jew now, after Art Scroll, can open up Masechta Bava Kamma and study the Masechta. That's a real problem. But in the initial stage, you know, when you know, in the pre-Art Scroll stage, I don't mean Dafka Art Scroll, I'm using Art Scroll as a code word, but in that pre-Art Scroll stage, the Moshe Rabbeinu stage, you know, the Torah was meant to be transmitted in other languages. It was meant to remain the Torah Shebal Peh. It wasn't meant to be handed down to the other nations. So you're right. Asar B'Tevis, we're going to mourn M-O-U-R-N over the accessibility of the Torah. In that case, Torah Shebichsav to the nations of the world. And what happened was, as a result, the nations of the world fakrum to Torah. You know, they distorted the Torah,
right.
And they reinterpreted Psukim, and that led to the Christian understanding, for example, of the written Torah. That's all something else. What we're talking about is the accessibility of Torah to the Jewish nation in other languages, meaning that we should have the ability to live in Portugal and understand the Torah, transmit the Torah in Portuguese.
That's for us and not for them.
And that's for us and not for them. Again, what about Art Scroll? And you'll have to read the introduction to Art Scroll. He's got pages and pages on trying to justify that. It's low pashut, as we say. You know, as much as we love Art Scroll, there's a downside to it. But in the ultimate balance, you know, you have to understand, you know, this is what Rebbe calls Eis Lassel Slashem, a favorite source of Sefer. So the benefit of the Torah, we're going to violate the Torah.
No, that's our mission, you know, to be Orle Goyim. It's try to explain and communicate.
Right. Listen, if you want a job, I can get you a job in Korea. I'm not joking. The Koreans are looking for Talmud teachers to come teach the Koreans, you know, Talmud. Because as much as they love the Talmud, they figure that's, you know, that's the Yiddish cup, they still are having trouble. Even with Art Scroll, they're having trouble. So they need Rebbeim over there to teach them the Torah. So if you want to, you know, you want to volunteer for that job, I could probably, I don't know how much the Korean currency is worth today, you know, how much they'll pay you for that.
But it's
a fascinating phenomenon that you have a culture that is genuine. I'm not saying all of them. I'm not saying every rank and file Korean is interested. I don't know about the North Koreans. I'm talking about the South Koreans. How many Koreans are absolutely fascinated about the Talmud? I have a feeling it's a small number. You know, it's probably 2%, if less, of the population in Korea. But they're mamish genuinely interested in the Talmud. Maybe they're doing it for an intellectual study, but nevertheless. So that's a pretty fascinating.
I think they're doing it because they see it's an intellectual exercise and it trains their mind.
Correct. For them, it's an intellectual exercise. That's why I would be very hesitant to take the job. They'd have to really pay me a lot, you know, for me to give up on my religious standards, you know. They have to tempt me, you know.
You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to learn Torah just as an intellectual.
Again, just to summarize here, you don't have to stay for this, Michael, but I just want to summarize what we learned because we got through two out of the four of the Gedolim here, and he's saying that, you know, in order to preserve the Jewish people amongst the nations of the world, we needed to be able to dip into that language and use that language for our connection to Torah. And this is the position of the Chidushe Arim. So when we get back to the pasuk Hoyel Moshe Be'er Asat Torah Zos, Rashi says B'Shivim Lashon Pirshul Lahem, he explained the Torah in 70 languages, that Moshe Rabbeinu at the end of his career, again we have to emphasize that this was at the end of his career, he realized that the Jewish people were going to go into Golus, and he was the Tzadik Hador, and it was his responsibility to somehow, you know, prevent a tragedy in which the Jewish people would fall into the nations of the world, into the bosom of those nations, and be so overwhelmed by their cultures and their darkness and their antithetical movements against the Torah Kedoshah. This was what he did, was by translating the Torah into 70 languages. Okay, then, so I'm going to make a note where we get up to here, and we'll see if we have a chance to finish it all.